I think Israel, a complicated picture, is that right? I can't remember what I wrote down there, but I've changed the title anyway, so dismiss that. I've called it Israel, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Israel, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Sort of, it is a complicated picture, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I'm just wondering if I asked you honestly just to reflect in your own thoughts for a moment about what you make of the church. Not just talking about this church. You can think for a second about what you think of this church, really, as a how we stand. You know, what kind of a church are we? And then perhaps if you just widen your thoughts out, think about the churches in the area, what the Church of Jesus, the Christians in this part, what kind of a presence that is. What's the character of God's people around here? What's what they're like? Don't have to necessarily fit it into the categories of the good, the bad, and the ugly, but that kind of might give you a place to start. And what about the churches across the country? What's your sense of the Christian church, people of Christ in Great Britain today? Their place, their status, their contribution, their weaknesses, their shortcomings. Just have a sense of it. Just think about it in the West, the church in the West, perhaps, extended out further. And if you're feeling like roaming all around the world, think of Christ's people all around the world, in the four corners of the world. Just think about Africa, think about Christians in Africa for a minute, and South America, and in Asia, in Europe. Just think about that for a minute. Let's go even further. Let's think about how the church has progressed through the centuries, the kind of the journey of the church through the centuries. What's your picture? I'll tell you why I'm asking all this. It's because I'm interested to know, when you look at the people of God in the book of Numbers, that's the book we're looking at, and you can see here's a company of God's people, can't you? And I wonder what you make of them. I wonder what you make of them, your basic impression. If I said to you, just at a glance, the book of Numbers, what are the people of God in the book of Numbers like? All right? How close is the correlation between your impression of the church today and so on and the people of God as you see them in the book of Numbers? Just curious. Is it like, if the good, the bad, and the ugly, and again, you know, where are we better? Are we better than them? Are we worse? Are they more lively and vigorous in some way than we are? Are they more committed to God? I wonder what you think. So we're not going to have a kind of hands up and tell me what you think. I'm just sort of starting you off, unless anybody feeling bursting at the seams and want to say something about it. But I'm saying this because I think one of the unique things about the book of Numbers is, and the unique thing about the journey through the desert, is that you see the company of God's people. I don't know if this is absolutely true, but I think it's pretty much true to say that at that time, there were no other believers in the world. That's the lot. If there are believers, they're in that group. This group of people traveling through the desert, and they're not intermingled with other people, so the boundaries of their community are very clear, aren't they? You can see there they are. And that's where, in terms of God's people, if they're anywhere in the world, that's where they are, all of them. And probably outside of that, it's a bit doubtful whether if there are any. It's just a smattering, isn't it? A mere handful, perhaps, who might be in other places. But you get a chance, in one moment almost, to see the church today. It's so expansive, isn't it? God's people today, it's so expansive. We can't really get the perspective on it. It's so enormous, really. It's very hard to stand back and get a view of it. But here, when you look at them, as you're reading through the book of Numbers, you see them all kind of gathered together in one place as one community interacting with each other. And I'm pretty sure that the same factors that you find in the church today on its global scale, you would find here in this book of Numbers amongst God's people in a scaled-down version. So it's a great opportunity to study the people of God and see them almost like under the microscope, as it were, and learn lessons about them, and you can learn things in the same breath about ourselves today. I don't know if you're buying into my thesis, but I mean, that's what I'm thinking anyway as I'm reading this book. And I think when we look at the people of God here, you see a very complex picture, a complex picture. I mean, is it just me, or is generally speaking, if you say the book of Numbers, most people's association with the people of God in the book of Numbers is words like, if I was throwing out, complaining, rebellious, disobedient. Yes, isn't that true? I mean, those a lot of those kind of words are associated with the people of God. What are the people of God like? You know, there's a lot of negatives, isn't there, that are attached to the people of God. Is that fair? Were those the sort of things that came to your mind? Are those the sort of thing that come to your mind when you think about the church at large today generally? Okay, I know people are a little bit less committal about that. Fair enough. But some fairly negative stuff. Fairly negative stuff. And I'll tell you why I think this matters. I think this is important, why we need to have a good, close look at this. Because whether it's you that I'm talking about, or whether it's people coming into the church that I'm talking about, if we have a false view of the church, it can lead to all sorts of difficulties. Okay, I'm talking about pastorally speaking, it can have all sorts of complications. See, for example, if you've got an oversimplistic view of the church, if you've kind of, I know what the church is, it's like this, and you then act on those views and those beliefs, you're going to make some serious miscalculations about what you can expect or what you should expect. So if you need a really realistic view, I think, about the church. Now, you get people who have this over-realized eschatology. Have you ever heard that expression? I use it most days. Okay. Don't worry, I'm going to... yeah. Eschatology, right, it's the end times, isn't it? Right? It's the end, the consummation of all things, heaven, right? And it's going to come, isn't it? Now, there is some of heaven, and some of the gifts of heaven are already with us now, aren't they? The Holy Spirit, a sense of the peace and assurance, right? But if you think that as soon as you join the church is basically heaven on earth, that all that eschatology is already realized here and now, you walk into church, you think, and I remember coming to church when I was a non-Christian, I came to church, I thought every single person, right, was absolutely pristine, was a pristine holiness. That nobody ever did anything wrong, and I was the only one, this dirty, filthy sinner, walking amongst all these, the clean and the righteous, right? Because that was kind of my view of the church. These were saints, the saints. And in a sense, there's something healthy in that, but there's also something slightly unrealistic, isn't there? And there's an expectation that you're going to see stuff in the church that perhaps some things we're going to have to wait to heaven until we get it fully realized. Over-realized eschatology, now you all understand, means when you think there's too much of the end is realizable now. Do you see? Under-realized eschatology, the opposite, where you think, I've become a Christian, nothing changes. Oh, it all happens in heaven, it all happens in heaven, it all happens in heaven. Right? Can you see that? There you go. You've got a bit of theological slide rule there. There you can work that out. Use it every morning. Is this under-realized or over-realized eschatology? Okay. When you're eating your breakfast. If you have an overly positive view of the church, you know the kind of pastoral problems. Let's come down to earth now. The kind of pastoral problems you're going to come into. Because one day, this glorious saint, right, who you admire and look up to in the Lord, is going to say something or do something, and what's going to happen to you is you are going to stumble, aren't you? Right? You're going to be offended. You're going to be confused. You're going to be distressed. And it can unwind people's faith, can't it? I've got to find out the church is not right or something. Can you see, if you think too highly of the church, you can get into trouble. And likewise, some people, what's the other end of the scale? When you have such a negative view of the church, what's the problem there? Well, I know what the main problem with you have too negative view of the church. You don't. Go. You don't even show up. You just totally disengage, or you don't open your heart to people. You don't share your vulnerabilities with anybody. You don't ask for prayer or anything like that. So it's quite important, isn't it, to have a realistic view of the church. Because I tell you, once we've got that, it helps you to persevere. Have you noticed, as a Christian, you need to persevere? You need to keep showing up. You need to stick at it. You need to work at it, don't you? And you need a realistic view that enables you to you know, plot your course. Plot your course is very, very important. And it gives you a much more realistic view of the others around you. So when things happen, you can respond more appropriately. You don't go spinning off into orbit. Sometimes you go, well, of course, because I've got a realistic view. I understand the situation as it presently stands. Okay, introduction over. So, thinking about the people of God at the time of Numbers, let's try and get a realistic view of what the people of God were like, and let's see if that actually is approximate up to ourselves. First thing, let's look at the leadership. Let's look at Moses. What can we expect of leaders here? I think the fact is, the reality is, Moses is a human being, ordinary human being. Let's be absolutely clear about that. What kind of a leader is he? I think he is amazing. I mean, amazing. The godliness, the faith, the obedience, the day-to-day consistent obedience is simply staggering. My personal judgment. In fact, over 15 times, just in the book of Numbers, you find the expression, and Moses did as the Lord commanded. And Moses did as the Lord commanded. And he does it again and 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 again. It keeps going. So while we're all bearing in the back of our minds this slightly negative view of the people of God, we have to notice here this theme in the book of Numbers of this man who is daily laying down his life as a servant for God. Right? And that is quite impressive, isn't it? That is really quite impressive. In fact, if you look at the beginning of the book, let's just turn at the beginning of the book. In fact, you could almost say the first thing that we're confronted with at the beginning of the book, and the Lord spoke to Moses. There we are. And as he begins to speak, and there are various things that are addressed there, and you get down to verse 2, it tells him to take a census of the land, so on and so forth. It's quite a boring administrative task. There's lots of numbering, right? It's like being an accountant. I don't know if anybody else fancies being an accountant, but you know, essentially there's a lot of accounting going on here. And it gets down to verse 17, and Moses and Aaron took the men whose names had been given, and they called the whole community together, and so on and so forth. And verse 19, and they did as the Lord commanded. And Moses, and they camped in the desert, right? Can you see that they basically followed through on the instructions they were given? Right at the beginning, what we're presented with is a picture of obedience. A picture of obedience. And that's quite important to notice, isn't it? Boring, mundane, administrative tasks. People systematically, regularly showing up, doing what they've been asked to do every single day. In a very, very predictably dependable sort of way. Don't forget that. That's the point I'm trying to make. And as we're going on through it, there's so many other examples. In chapter 3, you don't necessarily have to turn it, but verses 49 and 51, you can see Moses being asked there to collect taxes and handle money. And that can be quite difficult, can't it? People are being expected to handle money, but money's coming in, it's been gathered, he's been asked to take up these taxes, and then he's handing it on to the people to whom it belongs to provide the services that need to be done. And there's an exceptional degree of integrity that we see. They're just handling money in a way that is godly and honouring. They're giving it out to the people that are supposed to have it. And that continues on in chapter 4, verse 49. And then later in chapter 7, verses 6 and 9, you can look up one or the other. But he's told, in fact, to give certain jobs to certain people and certain equipment to other people, and to provide this and to administrate and to direct the work and provide resources. Nothing very glamorous about any of this. But does he do it? He's doing it, isn't he? He's doing the work. So that's important to notice, isn't it? And when it comes, especially chapter 8, verse 4, when it comes down to, because you know, Moses had a vision, didn't he? He was given a vision by God. And he wasn't cavalier about that at all. He saw something while he was up there on Mount Sinai. He saw a view into heaven when he was up there on Mount Sinai. And when he came down, he remained meticulously dedicated to making sure that as they made the candlestick and the other things he'd seen up there, that they were exactly as he'd been shown. You can imagine the craftsman who didn't see these things, you know, molding it like this way. No, 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 it's not like that. It's got to be just like, just so. He cares about the glory of God. He cares about the will of God. He wants to see worship conducted in a way that's honoring to the Lord who's chosen him and given him this vision. And that's moving, isn't it, to see? And like leadership is not always easy. You know that he had more than one trial. We're going through the book at the moment, chapter 11, verse 24. There are times when he's carrying around these administrative tasks, making sure that the vision that he's been given, because it's very easy in the mundane, everyday thing of life, that vision can get, you know, clouded and lost. It becomes brown, doesn't it? But he's staying committed and keeping the vision alive. And for his troubles, time and time again, sadly, we can see in chapter 11, verse 24, he suddenly finds that all the people are unhappy, that they're not really kind of satisfied. They want this when they haven't got that. And he has to, all this pressure that comes on. You go into chapter 17 and verses 1 through to 11. The other leaders are all carping against each other. Who's in charge? Do you remember the story of Aaron's rod? You know, the Aaron's rod, and who should be the rightful person? And, oh, we have to put a test in there. So he's sorting out the complex relationships amongst all the people and doing it in a very humble, very persistent, very consistent way every day. And that's quite moving to see, isn't it? And we have this very negative view of the people of God. But I think as we go through the book of Numbers, which is characterized, and it's so popular to characterize the book as the grumbling, complaining, rebellious people, to miss this stuff. You know, God's people doing God's word every day in God's world. And it's a wonderful thing to look at. And sometimes it's not very glamorous. Sorting out problems, sorting out relationships, doing administration, being persistent, keeping it fresh. But here he is doing it. And I think here in chapter 27, verse 22, he has a particularly difficult task to do because people, especially men, are naturally very egotistical. And they want the glory and on the honor of stuff like that. But he becomes absolutely certain, he knows that he has got to let go of the work and he's got to raise it up to somebody else. He's got to pass it on to somebody else. And you don't see him carping and complaining, do you? He identifies people. He identifies Joshua. He can see the Lord's hand is upon him. And he says, this is the person who's taking over. I'm stepping back. He's coming forward. He's releasing all the things he's been given to other people. I think that's impressive, demonstrative humility. Just to remember. Now, it's always interesting, isn't it? All these positive things we've been said about Moses. Who wrote the book of Numbers? Moses did. But do you think he's being honest? Do you think it's a faithful account? Do you think he's bigged himself up or pushed himself down? I think he's just writing it up, isn't he? He's telling it how it is. And we looked at last time, chapter 31, the war with the Midianites, chapter 3, verse 31. They were existential threats to their very existence. They were pushed to their extremes. They could have died out there. And he had charge and responsibility. How did he deal with those situations? He was rigorous. He was tough. And he didn't flinch when he was asked to do the tough things. He did the tough things. You see, this is a lot. There's a lot of character, isn't there? The character of the man of God here. And I would say there is an exemplary mark of obedience on this man. Administration, distribution, crisis planning, all this sort of thing is there. But what about the rest? Is this a book where there's just one guy who's kind of like the hero of the film, you know, the star of the show? Let's go to chapter 7. We'll have to go back a bit. You need strong fingers. Chapter 7. Again, I find this, chapter 7 here, deeply moving. I remember when I read it for the first time, I found it deeply moving. That all these elders and princes and chieftains and leaders of families and groups and so on and so forth, when they built the tabernacle, it was time now to make gifts and to furnish it and to get behind the work and pour themselves into it. They did. They built this thing. They provided the silver and the gold. They did it. You can take any list. You verse 12, this guy, Nashon of Anamidab, the side of the one silver plate weighing 130 shekels, one silver sprinkling bowl weighing 70 shekels, according to, and grain offerings and gold dishes. And they're not showing off. They love the Lord. And they're concerned for his glory, and they're seeking to be obedient to the Spirit who saved them and brought them out of it. I just think this, the generosity of God's people comes over in these pages to me. The obedience of God's people, the generosity of God's people. Let's just bear these things in mind. And, okay, leaders are fine. What about the grassroots? That's where the problems is. It's the oi polloi. There's always the problems. It's the oi polloi, right? But no. No, not at all. Chapter 1, verse 54 is just one of a number of examples. Chapter 1 and verse 54, the beginning. So if I can find it. The Israelites did all just as the Lord commanded. We find it again. The Israelites, the ordinary people, obedient. When the cloud moved and they had to up their sticks and move on and change, their lives were always being changed, subject to change all the time. They picked up their tents and their tent pegs and their tent poles and their families and their oxen and their cart, and they moved on and moved on and moved on. Look, what I'm trying to say, what I'm saying here is that, you know, I think you can honestly say when you look in the book of Numbers, probably compared to any time in the Old Testament, that here you can see the people of God as good as you'll see them at any other time. Do you see what I'm saying? There's so many examples here of real, true godliness. And I would say it compares favorably against the examples of God's people even in the New Testament. Think of any example time. We've been looking in the book of Corinthians. I know that's not a very good example. But look at the people of God in the New Testament. This character, this obedience, this generosity spirit. Don't you see those same characteristics in the New Testament? There's a sort of a consistency right across the board. And this is happening not just over a couple of days. This is 40 years of history recorded in this book. And I'm just saying, I think it's quite impressive. And so I would encourage you, apart from anything else, don't be dismissive of the Old Testament saints. Okay? And say the New Testament saints are some higher, better breed. And that we, the Christians of the New Testament, we're some... I think, let's eat a bit of humble pie. And let's recognize that the saints of old in a covenant was less favorable than the one we enjoy. Serve their Lord, as do we. And I think it's worth remembering. You know, we talk about Moses. It's so easy to jump to. Yeah, but what did he do at Kadesh? He bashed the stone twice and he didn't get into... The one thing. You know, let's go to the New Testament. Let's look at Peter. Denied Jesus 3 times. They say, well, that's before Pentecost and all the rest of it. But how come Paul had to write that when he was in Galatia, he had to resist him to the face? You know, even the very best, and these are the very best, they are flawed, absolutely. But let's not forget that in often what are quite mundane, day-to-day, regular, systematic times, and also in more dramatic experiences as well, God's people are pretty amazing. God's people are pretty amazing. So the first point I'm trying to make is that there's a lot of good that can be said about the church. All right? So there are plenty of detractors. Let's not just jump on the bandwagon. There's a lot of good things we can say about the church. Let's give credit where credit is due. Let's not be those who just systematically talk down the church. I think there's good things to be said. Let's make sure we say them. Is that fair to say? All right. So that's the good. What's going next? You any idea, Andy? Yeah, well, very good. There are problems. There are, however, problems. and Kadesh. Let's look at that. Chapter 20, verses 9 through 13. The striking against the rock. And have a word with Chris, because he came out with some quite interesting observations about this, that passage last time when we preached at it, the hitting against the rock. Maybe in the end, we can see that Moses, whatever good we, let's not get totally out of proportion. He is a man. He isn't perfect. All have sinned. All have fallen short of the glory of God, and he is no exception. So let's be realistic. There's a lot of good that to be said, and it needs to be said, but he's not perfect. He's not perfect. And Aaron, who had built the golden calf, and then, even though he'd done that, was still ordained as the high priest. I mean, the man knew forgiveness like you wouldn't believe. Right? And yet, you find him in chapter 12, verse 1, after all the forgiveness he's received from his own brother as well, who basically gave him charge of the people while he went up on the mountain and came back with all that, his own flesh and blood. And he comes back, and then here in chapter 12, verse 1, him and Miriam, backbiting against him. It's so disappointing, isn't it? And it's disappointing to see leaders actually showing this kind of rather banal traits. Gossiping, backbiting, that sort of thing. We don't expect that, do we? But we see evidence of it. We see evidence of it. And the other leaders too. All the other people we're talking about, they had their more than their wobbles. Some of them quite significant. Chapter 16, verse 1 is probably the most significant example of it. And again, these things get a lot of press. Korah's rebellion. You know, and he gathered together, as we go to, look in verse 2, he gathered 250 Israelite men, well-known community leaders, the same kind of people who were generous at another time. They just turned, didn't they? They failed utterly. Moral failure. They collapsed under the pressure. They blew it. They blew it big time. And the spies who they trusted to go into the land and bring them a good report, they were the pick of the bunch, those men. Each tribe had a choice of picking their top man to send in. And when they came back, only two of them came up with the goods out of 12. It's very disappointing, isn't it? It's very, very disappointing. And they led the others astray, and we read about that in chapter 13, verses 1 through to 14, verse 45. There's a whole section of the book that just, the misleading of God's people, because people just could not bring themselves to be courageous. Kind of a cowardice, you know. And for people themselves going down to the ordinary level, there's the lust and the impatience. We want bread, we want meat, we want this, we want that. And then the Midianite women come up, as we read about in chapter 25, and they can't keep themselves from them either. And they soil themselves and they destroy their reputations. And they don't glorify God. So, look, there is a lot of good to say, and we need to be the people who are saying it, but that isn't to say there aren't bad things. There is no sin in the camp. But I would say to you, don't let that have the final word. Don't let that have the final word. That is too easy. It's clear evidence, isn't it, that despite their sin, God continues to bless this group of people. Right, they start out in Sinai, they end up in the promised land. All right, the Lord did that, and their enemies were defeated. So whatever bad there was to say, in the end, did God use these people and bring them through? Yes, he did. And it's important to remember that too, isn't it? The covenant is with the body. And yes, parts fail, but the body is victorious. And that's the second point, isn't it? There is bad things to say, and we shouldn't be those who shy away from those. That's the other extreme, isn't it? It's all good. You won't hear anything bad. But the other extreme is those people who shy away from the fact that there are real problems. And covering up doesn't work. And I don't know about you, but I think coming clean is the way to do it, isn't it? To talk about these things, be open, be realistic about these things. Just very, very brief illustration. Noah had his sons, and Noah got drunk, didn't he? He got drunk. And I would hate to think that the most famous and wonderful thing that anybody ever says about Noah is what a fool he made of himself when he became drunk. That would be so wrong, wouldn't it? It'd be so wrong. And his own sons knew how wrong that was. Two of them did anyway. One of them wanted to make a big deal out of this. And it was a real thing, and it was a very disappointing. But the other two, they drew a cloth over it, didn't they? That's not to say that everything's covered up and we hush-hush and we don't talk about the problems in the church, but there is a degree of discretion and proportion about all of this, which is wise, isn't it? Which is wise. I suppose what I'm just saying, in summary, then, in the book of Numbers, the sin of the church is a real aspect of the picture, but it's not the only thing. So we've got the good and we've got the bad. It's not the only thing to say. So let's be realistic about that. And finally, very briefly, I would love to be able to say that God loves us so much that our sin has no consequence. Wouldn't that, well, I don't know if it would be that great. Well, what would it be like if you knew that your sin has no consequence? Realistically, what would be the effect upon your holiness, for example? I think it would go downhill quite rapidly, couldn't it? It could so easily go downhill. Would it be just? Would it be just if God exempted Christians from consequences from their sin and everybody else had to face the consequences of theirs? No. In this world, there's a law of consequence, and we're as bound to it as anybody, aren't we? In that regard, it's all the same. We're all treated the same. It wouldn't be wise to let us have no consequence. It wouldn't be just. And God, in his mercy and wisdom, makes sure that there are consequences, both for the good and for the bad. There are consequences. And I'm sure if that wasn't the case, we would flaunt grace. The fact is, Moses, for all the good that he did, but remembering the position he was in, he did one thing. He lost his job. Right? He lost his job, didn't he? That's a consequence. And this book speaks about consequences. Miriam, after all that she did, she saved Moses from the river. She danced that dance and sang that song when they came to the other side. She prophesied. But when she started all this, she lost her health. If the Lord hadn't healed her, she'd have probably died. And Aaron, who'd been redeemed and forgiven and given so much status in the community and been restored. That's a very sad thing, is when somebody's been restored and then they just do it again. Well, lowers your second chance. You've blown your second chance. His reputation was tarnished from that point. And Korah, people like Korah, they lost their lives. They lost their lives. You know, there are very real consequences. And as for the people, their hopes and their dreams, the things that they really wanted and desired, the land, the fruit, the milk and the honey, instead of being able to, you know, I've told you this, in the book of Deuteronomy, we're told how long it would have taken to walk, this is a test, how long it would take to walk from Sinai into the promised land. How long was the journey? To walk from Sinai to the Promised Land, 11 days. It took them 40 years. That is devastating, isn't it? How near are the promises of God? And yet the consequences of our actions can defer them on. And so we have to walk and wait so much longer sometimes than we ever should have done. And that's the ugly truth, isn't it? That's the ugly truth. Their setbacks and the plagues and all the rest of it were the consequences, the ugly truths. But there's so much good to be said. Look, the church creeps along, it does. It's always counteracting its failings that kind of have consequences, and it's been contended with. And the daily, regular, rather mundane and unattractive obedience that most Christians practice most of the time tends to be completely eclipsed by the scandals and the breakouts and the failings of the few. And that's the ugly truth of it. And that's what we read at the first reading in chapter 32. That summary, that in the end there's these consequences of obedience. And all that good seems to just get cancelled out in a moment. I think the good news about that is that even if our good, the good that we do is cancelled out by our sin, yet how is it that we keep making progress? How is it that there's any fruitful? How is it that there's any goodness or progress made? And you have to just conclude, it's just God's grace. It's about him in the end. And he perseveres with us, and he is good all the time. All the time. And we're his people, and we're in him. And while that's the case, we have real security, and we have real hope. We look at ourselves, you look at the church is not the answer. The one the church looks at is the answer. God is the answer through Christ. So, back to the beginning. Gotten a relatively negative view of the people of God, of the church? Well, it's understandable. It's understandable, isn't it? You know, we had the illustration about the white shirt. You're going out for dinner and you get this white shirt on. You got yourself all ironed up. And then you just think, there's that bacon sandwich just waiting for you with a ketchup on it. You just think, I know I shouldn't eat that right now because I got my white shirt on. But you can't resist it, and pfft, on your shirt. And the whole of your shirt is clean and pressed. Except for one little pink spot. And that pink spot shouts and screams louder than the whole shirt, doesn't it? It was quite an interesting campaign that I think it was one of the toothpaste manufacturers did. And did all these amazing photographs of people. And you looked at them, and every time you saw these happy, healthy people, and every time you looked, you couldn't help but go looking at teeth, because they all had like something in there stuck in their teeth, you know, just a little tiny thing like that. And then at the end, he says, now look at those photographs again. And the, you know, with Photoshop, they can manipulate images. So even though all these people had these little things stuck in your teeth, which you couldn't help look at, they'd done it so that some of them had seven fingers on their hands, or they were like two arms and there was an extra arm down here. You didn't notice any of that. You just looked at this thing in their teeth. So it was an advert for toothpaste. Quite clever. But the sad truth is that our sin is is very distracting, isn't it? And a lot of attention is naturally drawn to it. And in one sense, a lot of the time, it eclipses what is good about the church and good about the people of God and commendable about the people of God. And the world may not have a particularly positive view of us. If we ourselves don't necessarily have a particularly positive view, then it's possible the world might not too. Have you noticed? But the important thing is this. Despite the good, despite the bad, despite the ugly, God loves the church. He loves the church. You know that verse here, for God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have an everlasting life. The ultimate object of that "so" is you and me. So we may not look great to each other or look great to the world, but God loves us. And in the end, isn't that the most important thing? We may not have much in the way of reputation, and the good that we do may not go appreciated that much. And the bad that we do tends to cause all the headlines. But God loves us. And that gives you reason to get up every morning with a smile on your face. Okay, after coffee. A smile on your face. And rejoice. And rejoice. Because if he loves, if God is for you, who can be against you? We're going to sing our closing hymn.